much, Salvatore, for the introduction. And as Salvatore already indicated, this is about a project that's actually led by Salvatore himself. And we as STM, we do a part of it and we try to fill in the bit about publishers. And the project is about integration of research data and publications. Here's a full list of everybody in the coalition. And what is so very good about this coalition is that it draws people from many different backgrounds, mainly researchers, funders, libraries, and publishers. And the bit that I'm going to tell you about opportunities for data exchange is, because this is a publishers conference, very much from the publishers' angle. So, I have a few examples of what happened with data and publications over, let's say, the past 50, 60 years. Here's an article that featured already on a slide this morning. This is the famous paper in Nature published in 1953, where the DNA structure was revealed. And what are the typical characteristics of this paper? It was only one page, it had two authors, it had one figure, no data. Let's move on some 50 years later. That is when the human genome was described. We're now talking about an article that has 62 pages, 49 figures, and 27 tables. And the first few pages of the article, you see them displayed to the left, are all the people who have been working on this. And you can see also on the picture, it is hardly even possible to do all this in print because it needed all these foldouts and, well, it was, that is sort of where you could see the limits of the print era approaching. Then another 10 years later, the fact that the human genome was now 10 years old was described, and what happened disappeared in an iPad edition. But more importantly, the iPads, of course, are flashy way to do that. But more importantly, this was something that you could really only produce electronically because this paper had an enormous amount of raw data. The format used for genome stuff is the SRA, the short read archive. And you see it appears in many different formats. But if we look a bit closer to the paper itself has changed also. It has all kind of new features. I dare not say bells and whistles, because you can see that some of them point to very essential elements of the contents of the paper, so that's not just a bell and whistle. You really need this to enter into what the paper is describing. So that is how data has been changing publications in a very short time frame. And I have a few more examples. This is another example of the Utopia document. This comes from the biochemical journal published by Portland Press, who were one of the very first to implement the Utopia document. And here you can see that you can make all the illustrations and the graphs, you can make them interactive, you can click through to the data and do all kind of exciting things with them. I have another example from Elsevier, who's also very active on the data front. And what they do is they work with data that is not on their own platform. It's data that is usually in GenBank or in the World Data, World Protein Database. And what they do is they link to it actively, real-time, from within the article. And in the article, you have a viewer that immediately shows you the data that is in those open repositories. So this is just to give you a short trip along the horizon to see what is happening on the data front. And let's now go into the issue itself. How big is the data problem? This is a graph that shows how the number of data sets in archives is growing. And you see several different lines. You see the blue line is the protein database. The red line is the number of articles in PubMed. So there you see how much article growth there is. But you can see that, let's say, since the last 10 years, the number of data with those articles is exploding. So that is very literally how big the data problem is. For some journals, it has become so big that they cannot handle or do not wish to handle those data anymore. And we all know that more or less, a little over a year ago, the Journal of Neuroscience published this graph. And there again, there you see how big, how many megabytes they store in terms of articles in the red line on the platform, and how suddenly, since early 2000s, the number of data that is sent along with it explodes. And for the Journal of Neuroscience, this was enough to say, don't send us those supplements anymore. Our system simply cannot handle it, and most of all, our peer reviewers cannot handle it. Cell, I mentioned Cell there as well, the journal Cell, had a similar problem, and they were talking about, they felt like becoming a data dumping ground for all the authors who were sending data along with the articles. And they didn't go as far as the Journal of Neuroscience. So they do welcome data, but they're very restrictive now in the kind of data that authors can send along, and it must be data that is really immediately relevant to the conclusions in the article. So that's interesting as well. That shows a bit that there are indeed limits to what publishers can do. Here's a graph, again, about the data explosion. This was done in a project that preceded the project that we're in now. And there we asked researchers how they expect the amount of data to grow. And blue is current. This was done in the year, I think, 2009. Red is in 2 years, so that's more or less now. And green is in 5 years, so that's a few years from now. And what is very funny to see is that the smaller data sets between 1 and 100 megabytes or between 100 megabytes and a gigabyte will go down, but the bigger ones will go up. And as you can see, the terabyte era and the petabyte era are actually coming soon. And this was for researchers in all areas, so also social sciences, not just the typical big data areas like particle physics or astronomy or whatever. This is also what normal researchers do in their smaller offices. So, for the project, which is called Opportunities in Data Exchange, we've been investigating how journals and publishers handle data right now. And I'm showing you what we call the data publications pyramid, because the first thing we found was there's data, data, and data. And, and the main differentiating factor is how much processing has been done on the data. At the bottom of the pyramid, you see the raw data and the data sets as they are created and generated at the desk of the researcher. And at the very top of the pyramid, you see the data, how it ends up in publications. And of course, the difference between these two ends in the pyramid is that the data that ends up in the publications is extremely well processed, refined, polished, and you actually get, as a reader, you only get, well, literally the tip of the iceberg of the real data that is available. And then there are two layers in between that show different levels of processing that you can get with the data. Now, we've zoomed in a bit further because publications actually work with more or less every level in this pyramid, and that gave us the following scheme. And it actually meant that we found, well, you could say five ways in which data are published, although The fifth way is that it is not being published, so it's more fair to say that we found four ways in which data can typically be published. The first one is the very traditional one, as it has always been. There's hardly any article without any data, so it's the data contained and explained in the article, in illustrations, in little tables, but that is usually a very small excerpt of all the data that is available. The second layer is the kind of data with which the Journal of Neuroscience was struggling and with which Cell is struggling, because that is the data that authors tend to put in supplementary files and send to the journal. And, well, we heard the examples of Cell is really struggling with, it feels like being a data dumping place. And also what many publishers encounter is that these data come in all sorts, shapes and sizes, and that poses new problems of how do you preserve them, how much editing work do you do on them, do you have to tell your readers whether it was peer-reviewed or not, can you actually expect your peer reviewers to peer review all of it, etc. Then we move to a third option, which is now happening more and more, and that is typically the example of data that is being deposited in GenBank or Protein Bank, and to which the publication link, and the other way around. Another example is Pangea. You'll hear much more about that this afternoon. And several of these repositories, especially GenBank, one can say that the popularity and the success of GenBank also had to do with the fact that roughly 10 years ago, a lot of the big journals made it compulsory that authors put their data there. So it was a prerequisite for having your paper published in Science, in Nature, etc., etc. Then the fourth option is a very new one that has to do with the so-called data journals. We've seen the first ones appear. And what they do is they take the data that is available in a repository, and then the article is about the data, the quality of the data, the method behind the data, what the data could be used for. So that's a bit different from an article, let's say a more traditional article, which has certain claims and interpretations of the data. But these data journals typically want to describe data in the hope that there will be more reuse of it. And then we have the fifth fact, I should say, and that is that a lot of data remains in drawers and on disks at the Institute. And from a survey that we did, it became clear that more than 70% of research data never gets anywhere beyond the hard disk or the personal computer or perhaps at best a server at the department. So, from that survey that I just mentioned, we know that the likely short-term reality of this pyramid is like this. So it could well be that 70% of the research data remains under the surface, whereas the top of the pyramid is probably stable but small. You know, most authors will remain to publish in the let's say, the old-fashioned way. For the second layer, there's the risk that it expands too quickly, and we already see some publications really struggling with it. Data archives are considered by many, and you'll hear a few very good examples about it this afternoon, are considered by many as a very good solution, but unfortunately, many subject fields are still lacking proper, good, reliable, safe repositories that are acknowledged internationally in their field. So, in fact, the bottom is too big and some layers in the top are too small. Whereas, of course, if we would draw the ideal pyramid, it would probably look like this. There will always be unpublished data, perhaps also because researchers want to wait with publishing or have to recheck or have to analyze the data or whatever. So there will always be the lower level. Hopefully, there will be many more reliable data archives, and hopefully they will work really good with publishers and other stakeholders so that there will be seamless links between publications and data, that there will be more data journals describing this data. Hopefully, article supplements will only be used for essential stuff that the article cannot do without. So there will be a layer there, but hopefully not too big. And data in publications, it would be good if there's more integration of text and data, as we saw in some of the examples with viewers that activate the data and the Utopia documents, of which you saw the examples this morning, etc. Okay, no report without some recommendations. So I'll quickly show them to you. How can publishers help to make things better and to achieve the ideal data publications pyramid? It would be good if there would be more publications adopting editorial policies that really encourage authors to make their data available. Right now, many do that by the letter, but there have also been studies that you know, even for PLOS, who have it as an official condition, there was a study that no more than one out of articles really had the data available. Secondly, it will help if journals recommend reliable and trustworthy data archives to their authors, so that they say, don't send it here, but send it to a good archive. Enhance the articles for better integration. Have good data citation guidelines. Sponsor data journals. Have persistent identifiers in place. And of course, publishers usually prefer the DOI for that. And in general, partner with all the stakeholders in this area. Then I have a very last slide. What might the future article look like? Well, if there's so much more data available, articles can become less linear and more jump at different layers for different experts or experts with different interests to all kind of underlying elements. Data, multimedia, and other original material might become separately citable items, very important for the recognition of people who have created it. Underlying data, whether they are in repositories or in supplements, doesn't matter, but they will become more integrated elements of the article by all these interactive viewers and other bells and whistles. And in that way, the articles will become more interactive. And also, if we zoom in on the data archives, it's not just a matter of linking from the publications to the archives, but it's also very important if those archives become more used, that people who stumble on data in such an archive, that they get automatic links to all the publications that have said something about that data, because that gives the real reusability context about it. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Epke, for staying on the time. We have time for a couple of questions. Cave on the back.
Thank you. Cave from River Valley. Anything about the format of data? I could have a lot of data, but it needs some proprietary application to run it. So unless it's some kind of open format, it could be completely useless data to other people.
Yeah, that is a very good point, because the format of data is something that is impossible to solve across different subject areas. I believe somebody explained to me that even in astronomy, you have like 20 different data types of forms. I'm looking at Fred Dilla because he probably has better say yes. But in many areas, you know, even within the subject discipline for data, you have enormous different formats. And if you extend data also to include multimedia, then of course the number of formats even explode. That is also what makes it so difficult for a publisher, even a publisher in one area, like a journal of neuroscience, to handle all those different data and to ensure it's preservation and its future accessibility and stuff like that. And that is also something that probably data archives can do much better. So, you know, any publisher in the audience who's still contemplating whether they want to do something with data themselves, my advice would be look well at what kind of expertise you find at data archives, because that is exactly what they do. You know, if you submit your data to GenBank or the protein database, you have to comply to the data formats that they ask from you. And that is also what makes such a database so usable for another user, because they can look across data from many different sources, because it has been normalized and standardized.
Bernard Schutz, Max Planck Society. I just wanted to comment in astronomy, where open data has long been the practice for space missions and so on. The typical practice has been to make a reference in a published paper to an archive which holds the data, but then the user has to go to the archive and retrieve the data themselves. And the reason for that is, typically, you have to register, you have to be known to the archive, you have to understand the data formats. As you said, the data, there are standard data formats, but you have to understand them. And in cases like that, I don't see how one could more closely integrate the data with the published article, because there are these access issues that are even for a public database where you have to have a certain amount of expertise before you can access the data. So would you like to comment on how astronomers might be able to integrate their...
I'm not an astronomer, so that's difficult to do. I was involved many years ago in the launch of a journal that we called New Astronomy, where we actually tried to bring a lot of data in an interactive way to the web. So I'm sure that there are all kind of possibilities there, but this is typically an example which indicates how different it can be from subject area to subject area. For example, if I take you from astronomy to social sciences or humanities, where the researcher usually works with much smaller data sets, and for example, data gathered from surveys stuff like that. There it can be extremely interesting if researchers between each other can share those data sets and make them into bigger ones. And you can typically think of research questions like, can I test my hypothesis on your data? Or can we put your hypothesis on my data? And, you know, stuff like that. And I can see a way in which publications would help to bridge those connections.